In Germany this past week, a record-setting athlete competed for the last time, he says, in an event that made him famous, the unusual sport of backwards running. This champion now says he wants to head in a new direction. Reporter Caitlin Carroll spoke with him in Hanover, Germany, and filed this report.
About 1,000 runners pack into Hanover's Convention Center. Their 10-kilometer race will snake among the gadget booths and through showrooms of CeBIT, one of the world's largest technology fairs. Most of the competitors will run forward to the finish line. Achim Aretz will be sprinting backwards.
Today I want to stay under 50 minutes over 10K, and my world record is 40 minutes 02.
Aretz holds a Guinness World Record in backwards running for the half marathon. Backwards running is sometimes called retro running and has fans all around the world. The 27-year-old geosciences student discovered retro running a few years ago when he woke up with a hangover and went jogging with a friend.
My friend ran backwards because I was so slow, because I had a headache.
He and his friend started running backwards all the time. Then Aretz began competing. Aretz jogs a few laps backwards to warm up for the race. He says it looks more dangerous than it is. He's only fallen once during his treks across forests and busy streets.
When I'm running alone, I have to look back maybe every 10 meters. And when I'm running together with friends, they can tell me what lies behind me and they can warn me.
Aretz gets a lot of attention when he runs. Children and dogs like to chase him. Adults usually just ask why. He says for him, it's more than a sport. It's a way of life.
Because it's not only the new muscles that you build, it's also mentally a change. In your, when you run backwards for 20 or 30 kilometers, sometimes I feel that I fly.
But Aretz's flying days are numbered. He says this is his last competitive race as a backwards runner. He's tired of the comments and the attention. He wants to run forward like other people.
Maybe there will come something totally different, but now for the future, I don't need to be so crazy anymore.
It's time for the race to begin. The race goes quickly. Aretz clocks in under 47 minutes. He's red-faced and breathing hard at the finish line.
How does it feel after
your last race? It was so much fun that I don't know whether it was really my last race.
So maybe he's reconsidering. Or should I say, looking back on his decision?
Yeah, I somehow do.
And somehow that isn't surprising. For NPR News, I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Marilyn Robinson has a new book out. This doesn't happen all that often, so we want to call attention to it. This book is a collection of essays. Many of them explore some of the ideas she writes about in her novels. The collection is called When I Was a Child, I Read Books. Ms. Robinson is in Iowa City, speaking to us from member station WSUI at the University of Iowa. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, the title essay, When I Was a Child, I Read Books, that's in the middle of the book, and it begins, "When I was a child, I read books. My reading was not indiscriminate. I preferred books that were old and thick and hard. I made vocabulary lists." I wonder if you could read another few lines from the first page of that same essay.
Right. "Relevance was precisely not an issue for me. I looked to Galilee for meaning and to Spokane for orthodonture, and beyond that, the world where I was, I found entirely sufficient. It may seem strange to begin a talk about the West in terms of old books that had nothing Western about them, and of naive fabrications of stodgily fantastical, authoritative worlds which answered only to my own forming notions of meaning and importance. But I think it was, in fact, peculiarly Western to feel no tie of particularity to any single past or history, to experience that much underrated thing called deracination, the meditative free appreciation of whatever comes under one's eye, without any need to make such tedious judgments as mine or not mine."
Where did you grow up as this child who read books?
I grew up in small town, northern Idaho, west of Montana.
I gather that West is an important idea for you.
Well, it is. You know, I started writing actually when I was in college, partly because I felt as if the idea of the West was so misunderstood by people. Probably the understanding of the West has never recovered from the dime novel. And the idea that it's male, essentially, and that it is violent. And I just felt as if what was beautiful about it was really lost in this, you know, these very often very cheap dramas of violence and maleness.
And what were some of the old, thick, hard books that you're talking about here?
Well, I was very interested in history, you know, and so I read things like a biography of Oliver Cromwell and anything that I could get my hands on about chivalry. My grandfather, he went to college, and I think he was a history major. He had a big bookcase full of very old history books that my brother and I used to go through, sitting on the floor, you know, reading about the Roman Empire and so on. Well, I was always very interested in that sort of thing.
Another idea that you seem to be turning over and over in this collection is politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that I'm getting a sense that you think these politicians who are carrying on about character are leaving out something essential about the American character.
I think that that's very true. I think that American history has been very seriously misrepresented in most of the conversation that's gone on about it. I talk about John Winthrop's model of Christian charity as his, you know, the Arabella speech, and how that is consistently misquoted in a way that can only mean that nobody has read it.
John Winthrop, we probably ought to mention, was a great Puritan.
Yes, exactly. In the 17th century, he gave a lecture to, or a sermon, whatever it was, to people coming on the ship Arabella, which was one of the earliest ships to bring Puritan settlers into Massachusetts. The idea that we were a city on the hill meant, as it means in the Bible, that our sins and failures would be particularly conspicuous and impossible to conceal. And Winthrop makes that point very clearly. And then along comes the idea that we're suddenly boasting of being a shining city on a hill. There's no shining in Winthrop. It's an argument, basically, that we have to be generous toward one another in order not to fail. That's what he's saying.
I like the thread of faith that I find in these essays, and it's also part of your novels. I have the impression that you had some kind of a reaffirmation experience in the middle of your life. Maybe I'm making this up, but it seems to me that you allude to it in the essay called Wondrous Love on page 125. And I'd like you to read a few lines from that. You say that some of the things that have become important to you, you could never have anticipated.
This is page 125.
Uh-huh.
The importance to me of elderly and old American hymns is certainly one example. They can move me so deeply that I have difficulty even speaking about them. The old ballad in the voice of Mary Magdalene, who walked in the garden alone, imagines her tarrying there with the newly risen Jesus in the light of a day which was certainly the most remarkable daybreak since God said, "Let there be light."
Now, you also say, very early in this essay, that you never actually liked that hymn until you did like that hymn.
Yes. I have never heard it sung well. That is a fact. There's something about it that just, it's harder than the national anthem, I think.
Well, I can tell you from many years of my childhood of singing it that I think you're right. It has a sort of a seesaw rhythm to it that is just very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the discussion of hymns in this essay then moves into a discussion of narrative, mm-hmm. and that this seems to be something that people require, stories.
That seems to be true. There's a huge demand for them, in fact. The use of fiction gives us models of possibility. It gives us ways in which event can fall out, you know. And it also gives us the pleasure of a sort of deeper competence, as if we see a wider landscape because we have put ourselves through the rehearsal of possibility in these various ways.
Marilyn Robinson won the Pulitzer Prize for her novel Gilead. Her new collection of essays is called When I Was a Child, I Read Books. Ms. Robinson, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. In Northern California, the city of Stockton is on the brink of bankruptcy. Stockton's road to insolvency is a long one, and as NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports, it appears that, financially speaking, everything that could go wrong in Stockton did go wrong.
I'm standing at Weber's Point in downtown Stockton on a marina that symbolizes this city's pain and promise. You see, Stockton is an inland, Central Valley city of nearly 300,000 residents. Beyond this marina is the San Joaquin Delta with a channel to the San Francisco Bay. And on this waterfront, there's a sports arena, a new baseball park, and a renovated hotel, and they're all reminders of Stockton's better days.
Just a few steps away from the waterfront is Stockton's aging City Hall and the office of Mayor Ann Johnston. She points to a series of large photos of those major downtown landmarks all developed in the last decade.
When we went on a real spending spree and built the arena, the ballpark, a lot of community infrastructure, did a whole lot of things to improve the community that were bonded. I mean, these were all financed through municipal bonds.
In other words, borrowed money to the tune of more than $300 million. City leaders were confident that they could repay that debt because Stockton was riding the crest of the housing boom.
Stockton had become the affordable housing for the Bay Area. So we saw an influx of many Bay Area residents coming to Stockton, buying brand new homes at very reasonable prices. And the city leaders thought this was going to continue forever.
But today, those homes that sold for more than $400,000 are now going for less than $150,000. And Stockton has one of the highest foreclosure rates in the country. Property tax revenues have crashed. Unemployment runs at almost 20%. At a downtown pawn shop, owner Tim Cassidy sees a lot of new customers.
Both in good times and bad times, we see the best and the worst. You're right. It's a very tough situation for a lot of people, unfortunately.
Cassidy says Stockton might be okay if the housing market hadn't crashed.
When the real estate was booming and the money was coming in, naturally the politicians, being politicians, made everybody happy. Police department, the fire departments all got handsome wages and retirement plans, the same as city officials.
But now the bill for those public employee benefits has come due. At a recent news conference, Stockton City Manager Bob Dice said that at one point in the 1990s, Stockton offered one of the most generous health plans in California.
City employees only had to work 1 month, and then they could retire, and the city would pick up their insurance for free, for them and their spouse for the rest of their lives.
Dice says that plan resembled, in his words, a Ponzi scheme.
Right now, we have an unfunded liability in the retiree health program around $450 million.
Dice says the city is looking at a $20 million deficit in a $160 million budget. Stockton has already cut nearly 100 police officers in the past 3 years, this in a city with a notoriously high crime rate. The city council has approved a plan to stop paying its creditors and to enter a state-mandated mediation process with its bondholders and employee unions. If those talks fail, bankruptcy is likely. Back in her office, Mayor Ann Johnston says if there's any silver lining here, perhaps it's in the lesson for other California cities.
So I'm reading editorials from other cities. I'm reading, you know, whether it's San Diego, San Jose, Fresno, Modesto, they're asking, how are we in comparison to Stockton? Are we going to be next?
If Stockton can't solve its budget crisis, it would be the largest American city to go bankrupt. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.
This week on NPR, you'll hear some stories about areas of the country that are seeing their fortunes improve. NPR's Looking Up series, tomorrow on Morning Edition and on NPR.org.